Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John, and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello, people.
Watcher!
We're back.
Here we are again. Oh, fantastic. I enjoy this part of the week.
Yeah, this is the best bit of the week. Although I do fear we might have to try a bit hard to cover up the fact we've barely played any games.
Is it going to be quite a filler week this week?
No,
it's going to be full of interesting stuff. Don't go away. Don't touch that MP3 player.
So how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great too.
Excellent. With that, we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Yeah. Anyway, you have actually played these one day games.
Well, the problem is that I've played mostly one game, maybe two, all week, really. It's Planetside 2 again, obviously. I just seem to have gone a bit uncharacteristically monogame over it all.
Ooh, that's not a good sign.
I know. I'm such a butterfly. Normally, I flutter about between different games, usually running about four or five MMOs at the same time at once. But it's all rather been focused and concentrated into the maelstrom of high-paced action that is Planetside 2, which is quite unusual for me, really. I'm quite a sedate sort of person.
When did you become a shooter?
I think probably it's all to do with my dynamic new haircut, which many listeners will have to imagine for themselves.
Yes. I imagine somebody with a haircut.
Yes,
as opposed to somebody who hasn't had one.
I don't look
before.
A lot like my Twitter picture anymore, let's put it that way.
And the facial hair's gone.
The facial hair's gone as well. I know, I've lost all my strength, like figures of legend. It's terrible.
I think you'll find you've got all of your strength the moment your hair went.
I'm more streamlined and aerodynamic now. Let's talk about Planetside 2. Enough about my hair. It's been game update 2 this week.
I quite like the moment when... was it in the pub last week when you said that you could hear stuff again?
It was great.
Anyway.
There was, I saw I was in the pub and busy. I saw a lot of people tweeting, oh my God, it's 4 gigabytes of patch. And I thought, my God, 4 gigabytes for an update. That has got to include art. The only way you're going to bulk any kind of, if it's just code tweaks and balance changes.
A hell of a lot of code.
You're talking resources at that kind of size. So new art, new sounds, all that sort of thing. And it turns out they have. They've significantly redesigned quite a few of the bases. In particular, I'm thinking of the big tower that you'll find scattered all across the maps, with the two anti-air guns on the top and the lower gun deck, and in the centre of various sort of mid-sized outpost bases. That's had significant rework. There's new walls everywhere. They've actually put steel shutters over the windows because people kept throwing grenades through them, and entire light assault troopers in some cases. Yeah, so a lot of the bases don't have the gaping open windows that tanks on nearby hills can just line up and fire through straight into where the spawn point is. The internal structure of the spawn deck floor has been rejigged, so there's more walls and things in the way. Almost every outpost that had a spawn room has had its that had these sort of one-way force fields extended out to the external doors on all doorways of that building now. Basically, there was just a huge amount of spawn camping that used to go on. If you can get one of the heavy tanks parked in the right spot and just keep pressing keep hammering the shoot gun button, you'll just keep getting people over and over and over. Also, in line with that, they've rejiggered how XP works for kills. It is very much more in line with how the first game worked now, which is that the longer your opponent had been alive, the more XP he's worth.
That's
and that works both ways as well. If they just jumped out of the spawn tube and you gank them with a tank shell.
That barely makes it worth anyone shooting you.
I know, it barely makes it worth camping spawns. Well, it depends. I mean, there is still quite legitimate and sensible tactical and strategic reasons why you wouldn't want lots of troops to keep pouring out of the building whilst you're trying to take a base somewhere else. So I imagine spawn camping is still going to happen in to some extent, but the nature of the spawn rooms is extended in such a way that you've got a lot more of a breather and time to get your wits about you before you poke your head out and get it blown off by a massive tank camping your door. A lot of the larger bases have had tunnels put in them, like big underground tunnels connecting key locations of the base, and they've got these it's a lot like the normal grav shafts. What they've done is it's really quite funny. They've instead of inventing a whole new game mechanic, they've just taken the normal grav shaft launch base pads and put them sideways on walls in these tunnels. So when you jump up off the ground in the tunnel, you'll just get travelated along to the end.
So even more places where you can put mines?
Yes, I suppose. But a lot of these tunnels, I haven't really explored them that much. This whole patch only went in on Friday, I think. So, but it looks like a lot of them are one way. So it's going to be quite tricky for an invader to get into the base using them, because they've basically got grav shafts that are essentially pushing you out. out the whole time. It's basically designed for defenders of a base to get out and get to the relevant places quicker without being farmed from the air or whatever. You've got these underground tunnels you can use. It's all a bit of a learning experience, really. It means that us people who thought we knew what we were doing and knew the lay of the land are going to have to do a bit more learning and more familiarisation with the basic structures, because a lot of them have changed in some quite significant ways. Also, they've rotated all the warp gates. Your warp gate is essentially your base, your starting point that can't be captured on each island. There's three of them on each island, one for each team, and they've just basically, it's like football changing ends, you know. So maps that we were initially very familiar with one third of, because that's where we start and where we push out to and get pushed back into, suddenly we're on a whole different side of the map, which features bases we haven't seen much before. So it's quite revitalising in a way. It's a good way of keeping the game reasonably fresh if you keep rotating, you know, keep changing ends, as it were, because unlike football, both ends of this map are quite different. So you've got whole new sets of bases to learn, the interconnection and the natural route of where the Zerg goes next. There's some problem with Amrish, I think. You might have heard me bitching about before how Amrish is always just TR all the time. Every time we logged in on a sort of weeknight on Emilia EU, you go and look at Amrish and it's almost entirely red. And I initially thought that was just because the TR had an unlikely amount of random organisation compared to the other two empires. And I'm not sure that's the case now, because ever since the patch has gone in, I've seen Amrish being mostly purple. And that's because it seems to be the basic design of the whole island. I can't quite understand it myself, but there's something about it that means whoever is in the south warp gate gets much easier time of it pushing forward and conquering vast amounts of terrain. And
that's interesting.
That had previously been the TR. Whether the TR have got the commitment and organisation to be able to work the same miracle from a different warp gate remains to be seen, but the one time I've played since the update, it looked like the Vanu were starting in the south and had most of the map. So it wouldn't surprise me if we see out, if that keeps up. If, for example, they rotate it again so the NC are in the south and they end up with the entire map, then that basically suggests that whoever has the south warp gate has a much easier time of it. And in that case, I probably would expect to see the entire island pulled and retooled in some fashion. I actually had a look at the roadmap after my last week's emo outburst about taunting and stuff. I had a look at the rest of the roadmap, courtesy of themitanni.com, an unlikely source of Planetside 2 news, but they got some very good coverage there, actually, and as far as I can tell, pretty unbiased, because I think most of the goons there have just gone off and joined random sides rather than sorting a massive purge from one side. But, some good articles there, some good videos and all the rest of it. They're doing tips, hints and tips articles on particular bits of equipment and things. It's all very professional and quite good coverage. Anyway, the most recent one there, they had one of their chaps analyse the roadmap. And this roadmap goes on to about June or so. There's like a huge amount of proposed updates. And to be honest, apart from that whole taunting thing, most of it looks pretty good. A lot of useful and interesting tweaks and updates, new features, additions, new gameplay modes, all that sort of thing, all being proposed. So if all you ever heard about was the taunting thing and that's all you went and saw, do go and have a look at some of the rest of the roadmap and, even chip in with likes and dislikes, because almost all of the other stuff are sensible, well-thought-out ideas that may or may not be a good idea, but are, decently considered ideas.
That's a disappointment.
Yeah. You may have personal views on whether a thing you would prefer a thing to be or not to be, but the ideas themselves seem sensible and worth looking at, so do pop along to that if you're a particular Planetside 2 fan. There's talk. One of the items in there that particularly interested me was talk of Hosin. Regulars of the first game will remember Hosin as an island which is mostly swampy, with a big set of islands in an island in the centre with a dropship centre and all the rest of it. So I'd imagine that a Hosin island added as another island into Planetside 2 would probably take on that swamp based theme. So we'd get some quite horrific Narm flashbacks back like we used to do in the day. Norm. There was actually a base in the middle called Norm, Naum. And obviously puns ensued, hilarity and so on. But I think this is really important, because what I've started to see over the month or so we've been playing is that each of the three empires, remember, three empires, three islands, what do you think will happen?
Everyone will get on. They'll decide they've got where they like.
Well, what seems to be happening is that there seems to be a sort of informal territorial thing going on where each empire starts to consider one particular island to be theirs, which I'm pretty sure goes against the basic spirit and design of the game. The idea is that you've got decent three-way fights on three different environments that you can take and pick and choose. But it always so far seems, possibly because of this whole South Warp Gate on Amrish thing I mentioned just now, the TR seem to always be on Amrish. The Vanu seem to always want to take Indar, and the NC presumably then are left with Esomir. But Indar and Esomir do seem to be more varied and contested three-way fights. Amrish just, most people just look at it and go, not going to bother with that. They've changed incentives now from worldwide population to continental population, which might help with the Amrish problem. So what happens now, previously, you if your empire just had a very low percentage, you'd get some extra resources, extra XP per kill and all the rest of it. But it wouldn't really matter where you went and fought. Now that's keyed to the particular continent and the population bars on that continent. So in the case of Amrish, where it's like 60% TR and a few token NC and lost VS who are just putzing about in the warp gates, if you actually went there with an organised squad and started to make some pushes and kills, you'd get a colossal amount of bonus XP because of the incentives available on a per continent level. So hopefully that'll open the place up a bit more and tend the game more towards balanced three-way fights on all three continents. But I think the real solution is not to have an number of continents that can be divided by three.
Yes.
That way, at least one island will not belong notionally to anyone, and you end up going having proper fights.
Although the problem there was you just end up with one island with fights on.
Well, yeah, possibly. But just the idea that there are three islands and there are three empires does tend toward a certain territorial defensiveness, which can make just free and uninterrupted gameplay a bit inhibited, I think. I've written Power Drop Training. Yes, the five rounds rapid, going well. We had 9 people on the other night, I think. That was quite good. And tonight, I think we're doing Sundays as the static night, but there's people on all throughout the week, which is good. I thought some of them were just humouring me, to be honest, but I found quite a few people just playing it anyway, even when I'm not about, when I just popped on to say
they've
hello,
got a rota to make sure it looks like.
Okay, it's a very organised thing, is it? But no, it seems the game seems popular. There's lots of people. A lot of people sort of quite disheartened by the complete lack of any kind of tutorials or instructions or tooltips or help files or anything. I imagine that stuff will come. I think the roadmap itself does suggest something which sounds an awful lot like the VR training from PlanetSide 1.
You don't need a tutorial. You run towards the enemy. If the guy in front of you dies, you pick up his gun and you use it.
Yes, that can put people off, though. I mean, I've been doing my best to sort of talk new people through how it all works. And I think on the Sundays I'm going to be sort of running some kind of introductory, this is how to find a gun, this is how to get to different continents, that sort of thing. So if you've never played before and gave it a go and found it absolutely bewildering to the point where you just log straight off again, then you might want to pop along with us and I'll do my best to try and elucidate a bit. But quite a few people in there who've got the hang of it all and are forging on ahead. We were doing power drop training on Friday. I decided there was far too much mockery going on in Twitter, so I was going to throw them all out of a plane. So we did that, and it was brilliant. It really worked well. The galaxy is the piece of kit you need for this. It's only found in quite rare places. The Warpgate Sanctuary, obviously, the bubble there. Some of the larger tech plants and so on will have a special terminal. You won't generally find it on normal flight terminals. You'll only get your Empire specific fighter and the Liberator from those, but if you can get a galaxy up and running, it's essentially a flying Sunderer. It's a 12-man troop transport plane. I don't know if you can actually load a vehicle in the back. In the first game, you could get some of the light bikes and buggies and things in the back as well.
I'm sure if you're driving it fast enough, you can.
You often see people trying it in the warp gate, yeah. Basically, you've got the pilot, you've got 3 gunners, 2 side and 1 tail. Actually, I think it's 4 gunners. I think there might be another one as well, an underneath gun. I really must learn how to use this plane much better.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, we're using it quite a lot. The rest of the crew get in as passengers, and basically, unlike the Liberator and your Empire-specific fighter, you are protected from fall damage when you jump out of the plane. I think all except the pilot, who might be expected to stay on board. But everyone else can jump out from any height and land safely without taking any fall damage. Except the light assault. As long as light assault don't fire their jetpack until they're at a sort of distance that a jetpack could safely land stand you from, you're all right. As soon as you hit the jetpack button, it cancels your fall protection, I think. I don't normally do light assault much myself, so I don't know. But we did some science as well. We've conclusively proved that if you jump out of a gunner spot, you are still protected from falling damage. I did that by flying up to quite a high distance and then making latest days jump out from a gunning spot. He reported that he was alive when he hit the ground. We did science. This is important stuff. People want to know.
Oh, but you only did it once.
Yeah, we'll have to... Yeah, so we need a control group and all the rest of it. I know, proper science. But no, the Galaxy is a lot of fun. So basically, load everyone on board, set up the squad waypoint for the drop zone, the LZ. Well, not landing zone. I'm not generally that great at landing them, to be honest. But that doesn't matter because we fly over straight and level straight to the drop zone over the top. I'm calling out the distance as it decreases, and then everyone hits E when they're over the top, and then they go.
Do you shout, "Get the hell out of my galaxy!" first?
No, I should. I did see your YouTube link to Sheridan's speech there, but considering it's about 15 minutes long, I don't think we'd have time I wouldn't have time to recite that before we're shot down by mosquitoes.
It was ponderous in the day and slightly silly.
No, it's all good. So, and remarkably, everybody jumped as well. I didn't have to go round again a few times for the people clinging on the door frame or anything. Everybody got out. It was good. I was very pleased. They all sort of fell like leaves of death down to the
I'm a leaf on the wind.
Exactly. I don't know if you can steer as you're falling. I'll have to ask one of my science team.
One of the survivors.
One of the science crew. I think you can a bit. It's a bit like being dropped from the drop pod. Once you hit the ground, they all regrouped and found the objective and secured it and everything. It was great. We did that on an entirely empty and friendly tower just as a practice dry run. And I even managed... Then, of course, I have to go round in a big loop and come back and find somewhere relatively large to put down.
Top of the tower.
No. I've learnt my lesson with the Liberator. Liberator, I just have real trouble with. The Galaxy, I managed to land successfully a couple of times, actually. But every time I've tried to pick anyone up to be in the Liberator, I've managed to prang it on a wall turret or bury it in a treetop or something. But yeah, so I've actually started putting some points into the Galaxy and also the Sunder as well, because I just and also the command chat, the leadership stuff as well. I was saving for 1,000 for a gun, but you know what? I'm going to buy some bloody station cash because I've decided that I like this game immensely and they haven't required me to give them any money. So that actually makes me want to reward them in some fashion. So I figure putting down 20 quid's worth, 40 quid's worth of station cash, you know, I don't even know what I want to spend it on really, but I think it might be a suitable
it's always
sign
nice
of my appreciation for a game
like
I enjoy.
The game, it's worth paying
absolutely.
For.
Absolutely. I'm a notorious skinflint with free-to-play games. I generally see it as a challenge rather than an invitation to spend money. But in this case, I think they deserve some of my cash. So I'm going to go and get some station cash and use that to unlock some guns. There's an awful lot in there because the thing is, you can't actually use station cash to directly buy certs. Most of the top-end guns will have the option to buy them in certs or station cash, but there's a whole load of stuff in the normal, you know, things like armour, module upgrades, or things for particular vehicles that you just can't station cash. You have to get the points to buy them anyway.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Well, yeah. I mean, unlocking of guns is generally the out-and-out, and also all the cosmetic guff they got in the camo outfits and all the rest of it, skull faces, whatever. But yeah, I think so I'm not going to bother saving 1,000 for particular guns, because I can probably buy and unlock those, and it seems fair. Seems like they've earned some money, and I have no problem paying them some. So instead I blew about 300, 400 certs on various bits and pieces. I got the command channel.
Huzzah!
Yes, this is 200 points in the squad leader category. I don't know if you have to actively be number one in a squad for it to become open and accessed, but I've only ever been in leading squads when I've seen it. But basically, that gives you a whole other chat channel, which is leadership, the leader chat channel, and also it lets you broadcast on the yellow orders chat channel. In case you're wondering what goes on in the leader channel, my short experience so far seems to be a lot of name-calling and bickering about the correct use of the leader channel. I haven't seen anything tactical or strategic told to the other leaders in there. So, to be honest, I mean, I got it because I figured if I was, you know, running an outfit, it would be useful to get some kind of higher up intel as to where would be a useful place to be. But I've not seen it used for that yet. The orders channel, everyone sees that anyway. I get the opportunity to speak in it, but I'm not sure I have anything meaningful to say in it yet. But then often, nor do any of the people who are actually using it. So, you know,
fair enough.
It's very much what will happen, I think, is large outfits will have their own internal comms and they'll just get on and do their own thing. As for empire-wide coordination, I think perhaps it's early days. I think you'll find that big names from particular outfits will become recognised names in this leader channel.
You don't feel like stepping up?
I can't imagine our outfit will ever be a big thing, and I'm not a big name either, really.
With that kind of attitude, you never will be.
We shall see. We shall see. If it, I mean, you know, if it looks like I ought to be trying to get people to go places, then yeah, I might start saying stuff. Who knows? At the moment, I'm content to just watch and see what goes on in this much vaunted leader channel. But bear in mind that 200 certs is something that even I can earn in about four sessions.
Yeah.
Now, compare that to the leadership channel in PlanetSide 1, which you had to get to command rank 5 to do. And that was a thing that you only could advance XP for by being in slot 1 of a base capture. It took even really, really good players with, you know, organized cronies pushing, you know, setting up, passing around the number 1 slot. It could take them years to get access to the CR5 in PlanetSide 1. In here, 4 days. So you can sort of imagine that, I imagine very quickly almost every single player of that game will have the command chat access. And then what purpose does that serve then? This is essentially an army run by democracy, and it's more like an anarchy rather than anything else. People will do what they want. Squads and outfits are going to be the blocks that do the real moving and shaking. And I think that leadership channel, I don't know. I just think you'd best off spending your 200 points elsewhere for now, you know. If you're filling in, if you've got nothing else to buy, then by all means unlock it. But, or if you have a clear desire to want to lead the army, the entire army to victory, then I suppose this is one of the tools you'll need. But yeah, there are going to be a lot more other ways and techniques you're going to need than just unlocking this thing. I got the Galaxy airdrop airframe upgrade thing. Well, I think it's very important that if you're regularly using a vehicle, you want something in every slot. Yeah, it doesn't matter what it is, as long as you've just got you don't have empty slots.
Yeah.
So there's a number of options for the Galaxy defensive slot. I think I got the combat flares. I haven't actually used those yet. I got all
trousers or.
I see what you did there. Now this fires every 40 seconds. It lets you fire out a bunch of decoy flares, which will help with missile locking. Apparently, I haven't actually used those yet, but hopefully they're useful because that was a bit of a problem. On our last power drop, we were right across the other side of the SMA map, doing just sort of, you know, the big thing was going on at the main nearby bio lab, and we went off and did a nearby outposty type base, and we did it straight and level, drop zone approaching, everybody got out, they all found the thing, they cleared it and everything, but then one single enemy mosquito saw me coming in, totally ignored the people who were going to steal his base and win the game against him, instead decided to just chase after the lumbering Galaxy for a +1 air kill, and I went round and round dodging and weaving for about 15 minutes or so, and he was just pecking away at me with his little pea shooter, and there wasn't a lot I could do about it really. I had no gunners on board because everyone had jumped out, and yeah, so he blew me up in the end, and I figure that you got lock-on missiles and things firing at you as you're coming in and all sorts of anything you can do to.
Does he still get the kill if you've jumped out beforehand?
Well, I don't know. I think it'll track the vehicle kill, but he won't get XP for me because I'll be committing suicide at that point. I'll basically jump out and die when I hit the ground.
No, not if you come down in a low sweep at low speed. Mm-hmm, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, the wreck might land on me and kill me. That can happen. Or he might just come round for another pass. At that point, I'm going to have a very standard machine gun, and he'll be, you know, on a wide open snowy plain, and he'll be able to just pick me off anyway. I don't mind. You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it was a success. I got the squad where they were, and they captured the base. So I don't worry too much about KDs. What else did I get? I think I got the acceleration and braking and turning speed improver for the Sunderer, because we use the Sunderer a lot as well. I've decided that The cert points I'm earning will go to the stuff you can only buy cert points for, and I'll just see how far I can get with a 40 quid's worth of station cash unlocks, because I haven't paid anything for the box even, you know. And I think the Guild Wars 1 model is something I personally appreciate. Pay once for the game, maybe buy extras later on. And I haven't even paid once for this game yet, and I'm getting an enormous amount of entertainment out of it, so it seems fair. I shall hunt around for one of them station scratch-off cards at our local not-yet-bankrupt game or whatever. That seems the way to go about that. So yes, I think the next thing I want to get is the combat flare, the flares in the squad leader thing that drop big smoke flares everywhere on the map, because I think that would be awesome. That'll be able to show people where the landing zone is for the Galaxy, so they can come and watch the fireworks show as I come in way too hard and way too quickly.
Yeah.
Yes. I think with the air combat in PlanetSide, it's really something that you're just going to have to practice, keep doing. You keep getting special aerospace resources, which can only be spent on planes. So you might as well deplete the supply and have a go at skimming around in a side through. But yes, you'll bang it into a tree and blow up humorously. But, you know, if you do that three or four times, you might be, that's how I started. And I can now land a scythe.
Wow.
Yes, I'm absolutely terrible at combat. But, you know, that's how it starts. But originally, the first three or four, I blew up straight away out of the warp gate. So, you know, it does come to you in time with practice. And these aerospace resources, which you're continually getting paid to you every 5 minutes or so, can't be spent on anything else. So, yeah, have a go with a plane every now and then, even though you're awful, because it does come to you slowly. I think eventually, with enough practice, I'll be able to do some really quite heroic and spectacular LZs and dust-offs and all the rest of it with my fantastic paradrop squad. Yeah, so we're looking at probably 8 p.m. Sundays. I'm going to have to crack along after this, and we record this show to have a go at the first one. And I'll be doing, probably splitting it into two squads. We'll have a squad of people who already know what they're doing, and I think we'll put Teppo in charge there and send them off into the field. And then
poor guys.
the other squad, I think I'll be doing something of a more beginners. This is what this terminal does. Here's how you find this, that, and the other, just for the first few weeks, and then a half an hour of that, and then we'll take that squad and join up with where Teppo's at and go play the game. And eventually, everyone will know how it all works, and we'll be able to crack on. Mind you, just the sheer breadth and rate of changes they're doing on these big game updates, I think we're going to have quite a learning curve on a regular basis.
Well, hopefully they'll slow down a bit now and not be 4 gig each.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Obviously, any time they add anything significant art or changes to how the geometry of the world and the texturing and everything work, then you're going to get a big patch. I mean, most of the patch notes itself for Game Update 2 were very specific, changed 0.4 to 0.5 on shotgun-wise, radial blast cone. You know, there was an awful lot of very, very minor numerical tweaks.
Yeah.
But it's just fantastic that they are absolutely transparent with this stuff. They've just put it all out there, you know, and even, you know, various theory crafters can then go away and play with spreadsheets or whatever. But, you know, they doesn't look like they're hiding anything at all about what they're changing each time. Possibly so, you know, I imagine we wouldn't be told about network security issues or anything like that. But in terms of game mechanics and gameplay, they are very, very precise and explicit about what they're doing to every single number that affects your gameplay in there. So that's very encouraging, very good. Of course, if you don't care about reading through all that stuff, just go for it. You'll soon get the hang of what everything does. I think other key changes, you got to not be in a vehicle when you capture a control point now.
Boring.
I've seen that sometimes. Sometimes you'll get control points which are open to the air. They're in a sort of like a little courtyard inside buildings. And people with air cavalry will come down and hover directly over the thing about 2 metres off the ground, managing to hold the air cavalry plane still and manage to capture the thing with it without even getting out. And I think that is just taking the piss a bit. Although, oddly, I think what I picked up from various comments I've seen around is that the engineer's deployable stand behind it machine gun turret is counted as a vehicle for that, and that's a bit of a problem for me, because that's often one of the main tools I use to hold a control point. I'll get nearby, set the thing up, and then just hose anyone who comes through the nearby doorway. But apparently that counts as a vehicle now, so you won't be able to use those. That's all right. Yeah, I can't really think offhand of any other major significant changes, but there's a lot of it does feel like a slightly different game from what I've seen so far, having played in post-patch once. And that's one of the beauties of MMOs, is that they are continually evolving, and that's part of what you're expecting for the service. It's all good. I like it. So, yes, good stuff there. I've written FFXIII-X2. Yes, Final Fantasy 13-2. I'm still playing that. Basically, I had a brief interlude on the Xbox with Enslaved, which turned out to be much shorter than I was hoping. And I've gone back to Final Fantasy 13's sequel. I've written Wibbly Wobbly Timey Wimey there. I'm stuck.
Ha!
Yeah, this is something. If anyone's played Final Fantasy 13, you'll know that it's basically impossible to get stuck in that game. There are a few boss fights that you might need a few guides to work out the correct combination of classes, your paradigms, to get through it. But in general, Final Fantasy 13 is a 200-mile-long corridor with a very large room in the middle. Final Fantasy 13-2 is absolutely not that at all. It's remarkable. It's like they've deliberately sat down and just picked up all the criticism from the first game and decided to go completely the opposite direction on every single point. Final Fantasy 13-2 generally takes place as a sort of time travel story. It starts immediately after the first game, and various bad things happen, and time starts to go wrong, paradoxes are appearing, and so on. So you end up encountering this place called the Historia Crux, which I think is Japanese for temporal vortex. And it's basically this big corridor that connects various time periods together, and it's really quite clever. What it then ends up is this massive sort of netted web of different locations. And these locations are sometimes the same place, but 100 years apart. So you have multiple time periods for the same place, which lets them cleverly reuse world maps and just give them different lighting and stuff, but also creates these sort of interconnected puzzles where you have to do things in one time period which will affect somewhere else.
Kill the dinosaur
to make the oil, yep. And then some of the stuff you do during the plot starts to hive off alternate futures, which are denoted instead of, say, Oerba 200 AF, it will be 20X AF or whatever. So you end up with these side-by-side timelines where some things that you did in a different place has caused massive changes to a place. And it gets quite complicated. And so there I am, trying to work out how to progress the main story further. I'm on about Act 4 of what might look to be about 6 to 8 of them in total, I don't know. And I'm finding that I can't quite work out what's next, because there's multiple time periods, there's alternate timelines, and then you need fragments to unlock gates to new time periods, and I don't know if I've got the right fragment, or the fragment I need is in a place I haven't unlocked yet, and then there's a couple of them that are just these weird out there places. One of them is a massive casino that doesn't have a time, full of load of slot machines and chocobo races and stuff, mini
games.
Well,
you don't put clocks in casinos.
Well, exactly. And I'm just finding it absolutely fascinating trying to work out how to do it. Obviously I could just go look it up, there'll be wiki spoilers everywhere, but it's sort of complicated and puzzly enough in a way that Final Fantasy 13 really wasn't at all. You know, I mean, Final Fantasy 13, I don't even know why you had an inventory in that game, because it was all pretty meaningless. You just followed this great big long line through. I mean, it's much easier to make preemptive strikes on monsters and dodge monsters and not have to fight them at all, which is something the first game was quite awkward with, a narrow corridor with a big line of boss fights along it, you know. You've got this mog clock thing which lets you dodge stuff much easier now, or make that preemptive strike where you get a bonus hit in first. Much more manageable there. They've sort of jiggered around with the party makeup as well. You have two characters, Noel and Sarah, who you always have in the party at all times, and then you just swap in a bunch of different monsters you've collected with these gem things, and each monster only has one role, which makes life a lot more simple, but your two main characters can be all six roles eventually, and that the power ramp for them seems much shorter as well. I mean, I'm barely halfway through the game, I think, and already I've mastered, absolutely top-ended, about three each of the six different roles that are available, and you can swap those in and out.
Did you do the same three on both?
No, I was clever on that. I did some overlap. But it sort of more then works around trying to collect the right sorts of monsters and slot those into your paradigm sets. And each of the monsters got the Eidolon attack things there now. And I don't know, I'm just finding the sequel to be much better and much more interesting than the first game. The first game was essentially just a massive set of chained cutscenes with you doing a bit of bog-standard fighting in between, whereas this one has a much more feel of a computer game. You know, there are meaningful choices, there are different places to go, you can do them in whatever order you like, there's various subplots going on, a lot of side questing. You got these temporal fragment things that form your sort of 100% map completion, collect everything type mechanism. So you can get a lot of those for side quests and unlocking puzzles and mysteries as you go through. And there's I'm only about 50 out of 150 of those so far. So there's sort of play that will go after the end probably. But at the moment, I can't quite work out what to do next, because it's turned into such a sort of weird overlapping set of multiple time periods and things here that affect things over there. And I can't quite puzzle it out. And that's really good. I love liking that. I'm liking that there are things I need to apply my brain to. This is a lot more cerebral. It isn't just walk forward, fight next month, just walk forward.
It's like Ron Gilbert said the other week when he said, it's an adventure game, folks, when he's talking about the game.
Yeah.
It's okay to go away when you can't figure out something and come back in a couple of hours and try again.
Yeah. And there is elements of this. I mean, so obviously it's not a point-and-click adventure. It's a third-person, similar format to the first game. But just the whole premise and the backstory of it all and the basic getting about and doing stuff of it all is so much improved on the first game. It is like, It uses a lot of the art and resources and basic conventions from the first game, but it's like they thought, oh god, hang on, everyone was giving us a load of jip for this and this, let's make sure these things are really different in the sequel. And they are. It really doesn't feel like a sequel in terms of mechanics at all. I mean, obviously it's the same cast and the same world, but if you didn't like 13 on its own, you might want to still give 13-2 a go. You don't have, it is a standalone thing, you don't have to, it's not an expansion or anything, you don't have to have played the first one at all to just jump straight in. They've even got basic primers in 2 to teach people how the basic combat works, which is what it spent 60 hours doing in the first one. Yeah, it's just there as a few little menu side screens with some text on. It does assume you know how the basics work, but the basics tutorials and stuff are in there for entirely new players. It's worth a look, I think. Okay, I've written Tita there. So, yes, I'm going to... So, the guess the mystery object part of the show. It's not really a mystery to you, is it?
No, I know, because I told you
look at that.
To get...
Describe that to the listener, because I don't actually know what it is.
It's a magic box of HTC written on it.
Yes, apparently it's an android full of ice cream sandwiches and gingerbread.
Yeah.
It must come from a magical place.
Oh, he finally got a smartphone.
John finally helped me get a smartphone, yeah. I mean, my previous phone, I don't even know what the model number was, but it was at least 10 years old, and it turned out I was due for an upgrade, and at the moment I'm in need of making important calls to important people and not have the device reboot halfway through making them think I've hung up in disgust. So I thought, right, now's the time to upgrade. So now I'm part of the phone gaming set, apparently.
Yes.
And I figured, all right, I'll have a look at some of the games because I'm ever doing research for the show. I mean, it's interesting. You've often talked a lot about iPhone games on these episodes, and I've sat here and I've asked generally what I hope are intelligent questions, but I haven't really been able to interact meaningfully in these little chats because I haven't had a phone that can do this stuff, and so I don't play these games myself. So, but now I have. All right, I've picked out Tita.
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 Who's that published by?
I have no idea.
Is that a big game?
I don't know. I'm not doing very well at my debut on the phone gaming. Okay, well, it was on the application menus that were already installed when I fired it up. There's 4 pages of icons in there, and I'm slowly working my way through, trying to discard which ones amount to nothing more than back in the sort of in the late 90s, you get a Dell PC and the desktop just covered with click here to set up AOL. You know, I imagine a lot of the menu items in there are similar. Dubiousness, but Tita is essentially a game where you have to tilt the phone to steer a ball bearing through a maze and not have it drop through little holes. Very simple concept. You could probably go to any charity shop and find something similar made of wooden glass that does something broadly similar.
You tend to also get that game as an example in the SDKs for these phones.
Yeah, I don't for a moment imagine it's entirely novel or new. It's just a whatever implementation of it was on this phone. Yeah. But I've picked it out because it absolutely highlights what I believe, coming new to phone gaming, what I believe phone gaming should be, and that is dedicated to the platform and working well with the platform and the technology.
Yes.
So Tita basically works. You tilt the entire phone to do it because presumably there are little accelerometers
inside the phone. It's got an accelerometer in the phone.
So the phone always knows which way down is, and from that can work out how you've tilted the phone and where to steer the ball when you actually move the entire phone. And that is absolutely something you can't do on a desktop PC or an Xbox 360.
You can do it on laptops.
Yeah, I imagine some laptops and tablets have got that kind of technology.
The hard drives
as well.
Tend to have, all the tablets do, because the tablet's just a big phone, but hard drives tend to have these sensors in for detecting if you drop them.
Oh, right. If you drop the desktop or whatever,
if you drop the laptop, it'll turn the hard drive off.
It has enough time to shut, to park the heads and everything before it goes bang. Yeah, I see. So this is exactly, and also as well as technologically being well suited to its medium, which is a tilty flat screen. So in terms of time spent and so on, it fits the sort of gap. If you're sat there and waiting for a bus or whatever, or you've got a minute or two and you've just got your phone on you, this absolutely fills that kind of gap. I mean, I've generally been quite dubious about that sort of thing, mostly because I just don't have a phone. So whenever I'm sitting there waiting for a bus or whatever, I just stare at people menacingly. And so now I've got this device that can occupy those small gaps. I mean, I wouldn't sit there on the sofa in my living room playing it for 4 hours because I've got a PC over there and a 360 over there, and those two tools are much better for that kind of thing. So I guess I'm not really looking in my phone gaming for something that is hugely substantial and what people might call a finger quotes proper game.
You just want something that fills the exact amount of time that you have available.
And this is what you've been telling me for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I've just not really been listening because I tend to go a bit glassy when you get to your iPhone section. But I'm part of that now too, as well.
It's okay, I go a bit glassy whenever you're talking about whatever games you talked about earlier.
Fair enough. So that's very good. I like that. I don't know if there's a pay thing there or if it unlocks or whatever.
There are
it just
many
seems
games
to be a free thing.
This ilk.
Yeah, yeah. It seems a simple little thing.
Quite reasonably fun, actually.
That one just came free with the phone and already installed, so it's not like I've done any real research, but I have done a bit of research for the next one, Ingress. Have you heard of what this is?
I have indeed. Is it out of beta?
It's Google Play. No, it's still in beta at the moment. I think it's a Google project that they bought some company or bought it on board from Neumann Tech, something like that. You could look it up. And that's essentially an ARG. And this is another fantastic example of the game fitting its supporting medium. So you're out and about with your phone, and this Ingress game basically involves using ARG stuff to reveal a hidden world all around you, a bit like trying to find free Wi-Fi hotspots, which is also another game I quite enjoy. I just love looking at the connection list, just in, you know, normal places at work, at home, you know, places you go often, just whip the phone out and have a look at what's around you on the connection list, the number of Wi-Fi points that are around there. It's quite fascinating seeing what people name them and stuff. Not actually a game, that's just mucking
Welcome
the system.
Welcome to 5 years ago.
I know, this is brilliant. This is me all over. But Ingress is essentially a sort of, I don't know, a bit secret worldish. There's two factions who are fighting for this magical scientific technical resource that's been hidden and scattered all around the world, and you use your iPhone to go out and find it, or your HTC or whatever. I think it's only on Android, isn't it?
It is only on Android, I believe.
And now I finally have a phone that can do it, so I shot off an email to be considered for the beta invite or whatever. I've not heard back yet, so I don't really have much to tell you about that game, but just, I mean, I'm sort of vaguely aware of the general premise of it, and it does sound fascinating, the idea that there's a hidden world out there that only your phone can see.
I've always been slightly suspect about the augmented reality stuff.
Almost certainly it's tracking my every movement and farming it out to marketing services, but, you know, you pay your price of some sort.
It is farming out all of your information. But apart from that,
I'm sure it's probably fun.
I'm sure it's even fun, yes.
And I don't have that many secrets, to be honest. I just get annoyed with the calls and the emails, but, you know, it's not like I'm essentially a very private person. I'm probably doing a podcast about what I do every week for general reasons.
Have you got to the point
idea.
Where you only do emails on your phone now?
Not yet, no. It's an entirely new thing for me, a new paradigm, if you will. All I really wanted was a reliable phone that could make proper phone calls, and this device does a good job of it. Do you know what sort it was? It was HTC One S.
Is it a One? I can't remember something like that. It was, your requirements were it be free.
Yeah, well, I was always already paying so much a month for my crappy 10-year-old Nokia.
I love the fact that you're actually paying less per month now. Yeah, I've got a good phone.
I was sort of not paying attention, really, and the amount I was paying each month had crept up somewhat, and it turns out that I could have that phone for free and still pay less. So that was great. Everyone's a winner. Now I got a phone. I was looking at Dead Space on there.
Yeah.
I've literally done, like, the first, like, 1 minute of play in there, but already I'm seeing the high quality of it all. I mean, it is a proper first-person shooter on one slightly smaller screen, and you have to drag things on the screen to make him swing his plasma blade and all the rest of it. But I need to have a proper look at that before I can talk about it extensively. But
yeah, I played the start of it repeatedly as well.
What I'm immediately seeing is that device in my pocket is many times more powerful in every respect than my first PC.
Yes. Phones are now at the point where they are shockingly powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's purely about user interface at this stage. Is the screen too small? How do we work with making the screen work well? And can people press the buttons and use the controls?
Using that little black box there, my phone can put what it's doing onto the TV.
Yeah. It's just absolutely fascinating. So at the moment, I'm just mostly spending my time going through the 4 pages of installed apps and working out what the hell any of them are.
So did it come with Dead Space on?
It had an EA icon, which I clicked on, and that presented a list of 5 games. I can't remember what the other 4
Mirror's
were.
Mirror's Edge?
I don't know. There were 4 games that had trial versions, and Dead Space at the top said it was absolutely free.
Oh.
So I don't know if that's some deal, you know, Vodafone or HTC have made with EA or what, but I think I might be getting the whole of that for free on there, so I shall probably be talking about it in future shows. So there we go. I've come staggering into the 21st century. Somewhat late. Sorry, everyone. I was held up. Why don't you talk for a bit?
Okay, well, to start with, apparently everyone on the planet now has a smartphone.
I was the last.
Yes. I'm going to start off talking about Microsoft's XNA.
What is XNA?
What was XNA?
Oh, was.
XNA was the ability for you to write code and put it on your Xbox. And
from your tones, it sounds like this is not the case now?
No, you can still do it, but they're no longer supporting or upgrading XNA as a technology. So that moment where it felt like Microsoft might actually understand has gone away.
They've basically, so this is essentially them backing off of Homebrew, is it, for the Xbox? Have they not replaced it with some other technology?
No, but there's going to be a new Xbox announced imminently, so maybe they will.
Oh, perhaps there needs to be a new thing to go with the new
but
tech.
It is generally felt that they tried the experiment, got bored of it before it even released.
10,000 massage apps, and they decided they can't be bothered with it anymore.
Yeah, but there have also been some success stories on it, and it made a lot of people
happy.
Can you
name any? I don't doubt you. I just need a frame of reference. What were the best things that have come out of XNA over its time, do you know?
I made a game with zombies, things like that.
Games
like that which have actually made real developers out of them.
Right, got
people onto... there's a couple who went on to Xbox Live Arcade as well afterwards. So.
Okay, so this is essentially... Was that a sort of online-activated subscription-y service? This isn't something people can just carry on working with on their own?
Oh, no, they can. It's still going on. You can still use it. You can still make games for it, but there's going to be no new versions, so...
Right.
But it's the same as the Apple model, which is you pay an annual subscription and you can publish on the platform.
Okay, and that's irrespective of the XNA development technology
but
itself.
But the thing is, the Apple model came along. Apple... do the same thing on phones, and it's just a much, much larger market. And the XNA Xbox indie games never really took off at all because Microsoft got bored of it. Whereas they could have made something quite good and made a lot of money.
Commitment
they
and focus.
They decided not to.
Yeah. What's the state of Homebrew on other competing platforms?
None.
There isn't anything on the Wii?
None. Nothing on the
PS3.
Wii, nothing on the PS3.
Okay.
PS3, you're allowed to do things inside some games. Stuff like Little Big Planet have a lot of user-generated content.
I'd really call...
But that's nowhere near the
Custom levels in Little Big Planet's heart, not exactly game dev, really.
So XNA wasn't amazing, but it enabled people to release stuff on Xbox, which was good, and for a moment it looked like Microsoft understood. Now they don't.
Now it's all shut down back to corporate levels and huge studios and publishing deals and so on.
Yeah, and it's probably not going to be in the next version of the Xbox.
Okay, so where would you recommend the budding indie one-man back bedroom game developer goes now?
Same place I've recommended them for the last couple of years. Phones.
Yeah, so iPhone development, whatever.
Phones or PC.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because,
So it turns out that Microsoft just can't be bothered to promote that kind of... culture into the under television living room.
Well, the odd thing is they're now trying to promote that kind of culture in Windows 8 with the new Windows Store.
Oh.
And, everyone is convinced they're going to stick this time out. They're not going to change their mind and get bored again.
I mean, I personally have the attitude of wait for Windows 9. So...
No,
we'll see.
I have an attitude of don't bother waiting for Windows 9.
You're mostly a Mac person anyway these days, aren't you?
Much nicer.
Fair enough.
You can trust Apple to be evil and not.
Well, that seems a shame in principle. I mean, I can't say it's something I'd ever be using myself.
It affects very few people, but it's just
one of those statement of lack of intent. It's
one of those nice things has gone away.
Yes,
which is always a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are less options now.
Right.
Although there's exactly the same amount of viable options left.
Yeah. Fair enough. Carry on on the PC, and if you get big and famous, porting might happen.
Yeah, it's sad. Then again, do you really want to care about consoles? Is the console a viable platform?
I don't know. I mean, I've played Enslaved because I borrowed it off of you. I've bought myself Final Fantasy 13 2 just sort of, a couple of weeks ago, and I'm picking away at it. But I can't say it's my primary platform. No, I'm mostly on the PC nowadays.
I've
got this smartphone. Who knows what will happen there?
Smartphones... Well, are quite possibly going to destroy consoles. Or Steam is going to destroy consoles. Apple are going to destroy consoles. But the thing that everyone's agreed on is somebody's going to destroy consoles.
Because they've just been too slow with their console cycle?
Yeah.
Or that they're not offering the things like XNA and the extras.
They're old-fashioned.
Fostering a culture, yes. Yeah,
they're an old-fashioned thing that has been trying to be realigned as, the centre of your living room.
Well, the console goes right back to the Atari 2600 and before that, really, doesn't it? I suppose the first TV tennis Pong games that used to show up on Tomorrow's World as sophisticated entertainments for dinner party folk, those would technically would be console as well.
If Apple were to put games on the Apple TV...
Mm-hmm.
Or Steam was to release their Steam box.
I think we're seeing much more blurring of what the boundaries between one type of box and another is these days. So you can probably find comparable entertainment in a number of other places.
And the question is, does anyone actually want to be playing games in front of their TV anymore when you could be playing them on your phone or your tablet or whatever?
It's true.
So, yeah, it remains to be seen whether or not the next generation of consoles are a massive success. Mm. They may because at the moment, the console market is pretty much in an unhappy place.
They've all taken way too long to get their next
generation. They've taken way too long. Sales are down tremendously.
We should have seen an Xbox 720 and a PS4 by now, but we haven't.
Yeah. Well, we might see the PS4 in a couple of weeks.
Oh, right. Okay, we'll watch that space. But it's still taken too long.
Sales are down.
People are getting bored.
Yeah, people are getting bored. People have moved on.
People are finding alternatives, like phones.
Apple came along. Steam's been making massive headway.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, I just think that it's been neglected too long and it needs to do something to try and reinvent itself.
Mm.
Whether or not it can or not is another question.
Yeah. We're not just talking crazy, wacky peripherals either. You know,
no.
We're talking more of a basic reinterpretation and re-understanding of what the fundamental of console gaming is.
Yeah.
A waggly controller is not going to do it.
No. It's do people want to sit in front of the TV?
Mm.
That's the question.
People are starting to redefine how they just go about their entertainment lives.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot less based on the living room. My phone does Netflix quite happily.
Mm.
I was showing people at work the House of Cards trailer during the week, and it works brilliantly over 3G. So, yeah, if you don't mind watching your TV on a small screen or a slightly larger screen if you've got an iPad or any other tablet, then why do you need a big TV?
I think a TV will essentially become an optional peripheral from the core of the device, which will be essentially a phone format anyway.
Yeah, well, there is that. There is
send the phone images to the nearest TV if you've got sofas around, but otherwise.
There is that, and there's the plans for having a fully Unixed up version of Android, which you can use your phone as your desktop.
Yeah,
so you plug it in and it uses a monitor, a keyboard, a mouse.
And then mind implants.
Not mind implants. We don't trust them enough to mind implants.
I'll give it a go. I've got room.
You've definitely got room in your mind. Anyway, let's talk about a game.
All right.
I played two games this week.
Okie dokie.
One of them, STO.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. Carry on.
There was a free ship in the army.
Yeah, yeah.
3-year anniversary.
Turn out you didn't need to go ice skating for a million days over Christmas. You could just wait another month and turn up and talk to one NPC or something.
Well, no, you had to do a mission.
All right.
But to start with, there's the talk to Q, get given a stupid task.
It's always Q, isn't it? Can we move on from Q? He was quite interesting in Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah, and
in the first episode. Yeah,
all
his first
things
appearance.
As well, when he bookended
the very
the series,
first and the very last.
Yeah, it was all a test, and the test never finishes. Yeah, that was
but
good.
A lot of the mid stuff, and also almost any appearance he makes in Voyager, just turns into a wacky, omnipotent, bored hijinks, you know?
Yeah.
Which seems to be the route they go with in the MMO as well.
Yeah, anyway.
Q is not scary anymore, and that's a shame.
I wrote 1Q, 3 cups.
Okay.
He sends you down to Starfleet Academy. Starfleet
Academy is your we don't mind putting wacky seasonal events in here zone.
People only ever go there to go recycle their duty officers.
Yeah.
And basically you have to talk to little Qs.
Yes.
Convince them to go to a party.
Yes.
He's hanging out in the club this time. And
this is what Starfleet's all about.
Yeah, it's all Starfleet. And you have to guess which box they're in, doing the cup moving around thing. Oh, he's running between them. And I was doing it when I was incredibly lagged out because I was downloading something at the same time. So he was moving slower than the boxes. His arms were sticking out of the boxes, and it was very, very easy and very, very dull and everything I hate about MMOs.
Right. Yeah, it sounds awful, to be honest.
So after I did that, to see how bad that was, I then went off and did the proper mission.
Okay.
Which ends up, were you going
off... Is that exciting?
You have to go off to a nebula.
A nebula. Okay. We like nebulas.
Then you chase around a disappearing signal, just one times more than you get bored of.
This is all sounding very STO so far. Yeah. Carry on.
And then it sends you on a mission, which I have dubbed, a funny thing happened on the way to be killed by the Romulans.
Okay.
Do you remember one of the classic Next Gen episodes?
Probably not, but go ahead.
Yesterday's Enterprise.
No. Is that the one where they get caught in a Metreon cascade there's like Worf gets killed by a monster or thrown about? I don't know. Carry on. No,
It's the one where they end up going to an alternate reality where Yara's still alive and they're fighting and losing badly against the Klingons. And it comes down to the fact that the Enterprise C was not destroyed in a big battle and was sent to the future instead. In the episode, they decide to take it back and restore the world properly.
Okay.
And Yara decides to go with it because she doesn't like the fact that in the restored timeline, she was killed by the Tar Monster.
Yes, I remember the Tar Monster. That was probably one of the worst episodes.
No, it's not. No, it really is not one of the worst episodes. It's awful, but it is by no means close to one of the worst episodes.
Oh, fair enough.
First Ferengi episode, that is one of the worst episodes.
Wow, I've read Will Wheaton's write-up on that. It was fantastic.
Anyway,
yes.
I did this. The mission's relatively boringly straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit of space combat.
Yep.
Yay, we like space combat. There's a bit of running around on the ground. Boo, we don't like running around talking to NPCs on the ground, especially when it does the go to this side of the map, go to this side of the map, go to this side of the map.
Have you played an MMO before?
Yeah. You meet Tasha Yar.
Okay.
So this is alternate reality Tasha Yar.
Okay.
So goes back in time, ends up doing the business with some Romulans, and then there's Sailor, who is her daughter.
Yeah, I knew she was like related or something, but I never quite remember the episode where what happened.
So this episode is set between them being sent back in time. Apparently they didn't go back in time, they actually went forwards in time to a new bit of the reality where you then get involved because your ship turns into a freighter and it turns out you're a freighter captain now.
Right.
And you have to sort it all out by sending them back, and there's a temporal agent turns up in their time ship because you know they have the model.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. I just don't think I understood any of that at all, but it has given me some ideas to try in Final Fantasy 13 too. I'm going to go back to the very first time period and try to sleep with everyone.
The good thing about if you do it this week is you get yourself a Tier 3 Ambassador class ship.
Right.
Because the Enterprise C is... Oh, you do get to see the... you walk right up to... the Enterprise C when it's in dock.
They do a lot of that in Star Trek Online. There's a lot of meeting your hero subtext plot things, pretext.
We haven't seen the B. We've seen the normal one. We haven't seen the movie one, the A. We haven't seen the B. We've seen the C. We can't see the D. Have we seen the E? We must have seen the E.
I know the Odyssey is like your latest...
And that's the F. And we've seen the F.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes, you do actually walk right up to the Enterprise C along a very long corridor.
Just to really drive that home. Look,
every
you're looking at the Enterprise.
30 seconds,
there's
a force shield which needs to be disabled just by using it, so you have to stop and have
While we deactivate this force shield, have you noticed the Enterprise C?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So this is very much for the fans, then, this episode. Of which you are one, what of?
Yeah, no, it's not for the fans. and you get an Enterprise C at the end of it.
Okay.
If you do it this week, you also get a Tier 5 Enterprise C. The Enterprise C.
Okay, that's important.
The Ambassador refit, so you actually got a usable
one. That's actually important. You'll need the usable one because you get to max level reasonably quickly.
There is something interesting about this entire mission.
You've brought some objects to show and tell.
Before that, Tasha Yar is the most useless of the bridge crew, except, and I have had to reconsider this, Lieutenant Hawk from First Contact, who does absolutely nothing that gets turned into a Borg.
Yes, classic red shirt behaviour.
Yeah, but apart from that, the worst of the named... bridge crew.
Worse than Worf, whose basic purpose in the first series of Next Gen was to be beaten up by the new Monster of the Week to show how powerful the new Monster of the Week was.
Same all the way through it. Worse than Worf.
All right.
Because she did nothing and then got killed by a bit of tar. You know. And also...
Some sort of galoshes, surely.
The Enterprise C is the worst ship designed properly, the worst canon ship in Star Trek.
Okay.
Because it looks awful.
Right, you've got some little models there.
Because I have actually have the old model lying around.
Yeah.
So I've got the Enterprise B, which is stupid.
Right, let's have a look. So you're showing me quite an 80s design.
Yeah, the Enterprise B is the Excelsior with the addition of these two bits here on the engines on the primary hull. And the stupid ridge there.
Oh, there's some trouble now. I've snapped his nacelle off.
It's okay that they fall off.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's stupid.
Okay, well, it doesn't look too bad.
That's not a bad looking ship.
It looks dated. It looks of its time, but it looks all right. Yeah, quite sleek.
The Excelsior is one of the classic ships of the thing. Okay. Then you've got that one.
Yeah.
Which is the D, which everyone knows.
That's the TV series Next Generation Enterprise, yeah. isn't it? Which I always thought looked way too sort of fat and
yeah,
wide.
Yeah, I never liked it.
I don't like it, really. I much prefer the design of Voyager, yeah. to be honest, as a spaceship concept.
Yeah, the one good thing about Voyager is Voyager.
The ship
and
itself
that
looks
one,
all right,
yeah. the C, is meant to go in the middle of those
That's
two.
Awful.
That does not fit in the progression.
No, it doesn't. Well, that's because they've had some weird random Blue Peter competition winner design it, clearly.
No, I think it was kit-bashed between... But not even sure what kits it would come from. But yes, it looks awful and it's rubbish. And I saw absolutely none of them flying around in space after I did the mission.
There's not much take up then, by the looks
not
of
that
it.
I saw.
Oh, everyone's got one and took one look and thought, ooh, and then carried on with their Breen ice skater ship.
Everyone had the Breen ships. Nobody seemed to have one of them.
That's because you just turn up and do one, talk to an NPC mission. You don't feel like you've earned it there. If I ever go back to STR, I'm going to fly the bejesus out of my Czech girl spaceship because I worked damned hard to get it.
Yeah, everyone else is doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was my Star Trek Online.
Okay.
I don't know what my next...
Presumably this is all off the back of a new season release, is it? Or is this just a one-off
There's a one-off mission.
So is there a new season coming? Last season was New Romulus and the running around on the ground
there. There is one coming, I don't know when.
Okay.
But this is for the third anniversary.
Right. And presumably by the time you listen to this, it will have all gone away and you've missed your chance.
Yeah, most likely.
All right.
The mission the mission will stay, I believe.
Yeah.
But the rest of it...
Well, yeah, you don't want to throw away any content if you can avoid it.
Especially when it's been full voiceover.
With actual Denise Crosby,
yeah,
is it?
With actual Denise Crosby.
Right.
Who does do her best to make it not be...
I got the impression that
annoying.
Was what she always did, her best with a bad job.
Yep.
So, and a bad haircut.
So it was okay. The mission wasn't spectacularly fun because there was too much running around the ground talking to people, but the space combat was fine. And
so a bit of a low-paced lore outing rather than an actual massive torpedo fest.
Yeah, but it was hideously shoehorned in bit of lore.
Right. You
know, oh, no, they didn't actually go back in time. They forward in time first.
I think they've done a fantastic job trying to explain the reboot and the continuity and all the red matter and all that. Every time you're in... through a lot of the Romulan episode chain, there's all sorts of hook-ins to that stuff. And I think they've done a fairly good job of trying to keep together what must be an almost impossible task.
Yeah, they were pretty much dropped in it when the reboot happened.
What? Okay, well, we'll have to try and do a different universe with some stuff here. And yeah.
Okay, next game, the other game, Proteus.
Proteus? That's an Eve spaceship, isn't it?
No, Proteus is a game that's on offer on Steam, so, you know, I'm buying games on offer on Steam.
Because you have no self-restraint at all.
And it was £6. And people were talking about it, saying it was a fun little arty game.
Okay,
and
well,
it is.
Okay.
It's basically a musical exploration island.
Okay.
You've got this lovely little... flat colour drawn island, and you walk around, and there's music as you walk, depending on what you're walking around.
Okay.
And
that does sound very arty.
It's very arty. And then it's a day and night, and you see the moon go across and the sun go across.
Uh-huh.
And then at night, you see all these little wispy things going in a direction. If you follow them and stand in the centre of a stone circle, time speeds up.
Ooh.
And if you stand there long enough, you end up in the next season.
Okay,
so
the musical changes again.
Spring, summer, then autumn. Yeah, and it's a pretty thing. And then you end up in winter, and then after winter, you end up ascending to the sky. And it's pretentious in the extreme.
Oh, it does sound a little pretentious, but also fun.
But in the end, I quite enjoyed it. It was a fun experience.
There's definitely a place for this sort of
thing. The big problem I have is, £6 is a bit much for this sort of thing in the new world order of iPhone games and stuff.
Oh, I see. You think it's a little overpriced?
I think PC games are quite overpriced for what they are now, some of these things.
Well, yeah, if I think it's popular enough, it gets to redefine what the thing is.
This is a one-shot play it, never need to play it again job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just,
I can't imagine there's an awful lot of longevity
to it.
There's
no replayability in it, so it's just a bit...
Interesting tech demo that's somewhat overpriced.
Yes.
Hmm.
And there's absolutely nothing else to say about it. It's pretty, it sounds good.
Tick in the box, move on. Fair enough.
Do not try and assign any meaning to it, because that's what they want you to do.
Yeah.
And I think lastly, because we've hit our hour, is X-Wing.
X-Wing.
Yes, this week, although we didn't get to play it, I had to pack up X-Wing into boxes.
Yes.
To take along to Zozo's house.
This is your tabletop X-Wing flight miniature dogfight game with the little templates.
And instead we ended up heckling Transporter 2.
Oh.
Instead, that was a bad film.
It's a really bad film, but very funny if you approach it in the right mindset.
Yeah. Yeah, imagine, you know, we'd been podcasting it and we had half of Chaos Hit there, and that's basically what it was like.
We should have recorded it.
We should have recorded
it. 2-hour listen-along riff track.
Yeah. God, it was very orange and teal.
Mm. So the problem with the X-Wing game, which I think we've talked about before, is that the X-Wings, whilst very finely detailed and well-painted out of the box,
fragile as...
There's a lot of things that will very easily snap off there. Yes. So you've been looking for some sort of transport solution.
Yeah, because the box they come in, is useless for that.
Yeah.
So I was reminded on Thursday that KR Multicase have a set of trays for it.
Okay.
And I looked, and they've actually got better ones than they had before. They used to have them, and they weren't that good, and they were only available from the American
Essentially what
office.
You're talking here, you showed me earlier. Yeah.
Right? So it's blue foam, soft foam trays.
With sort of laser cut.
Yeah.
Hollows.
Yeah, so custom
cut. All the right
so
shape.
This one fits 10 and all the counters.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually... have more models than that, but you know, you only really need 10.
And that goes in a standard aluminium carry case dimensions.
I've got the aluminium carry case that it fits in.
Excellent.
But
can't see much snapping those off then.
No, so it's perfect transportable now. And I'm going to have to get one of the bigger cases at some stage to add more models in, and also the Falcon and Slave
One.
Yeah,
because these things aren't cheap, the little models. Yeah. So you don't want to, yeah, you want to look after them if you get
but
them.
But they're also, the boxes are compatible with the ones I've got for 40k and things.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
So the box. This can be used for either.
Just long-term storage and transport of these models is a real thing. Yeah.
I'm very happy with this. It's a very nice little thing.
Okay, so you can Google for that.
KR Multicase.com.
How much roughly did it all cost?
It's 20 something for the trays, which will take the entire starter set with room to spare for another 7.
So,
ships.
But if you've offset the cost of that against snapped X-Wings, then it's probably well
and
worth
then
it. Yeah.
You don't have to put it in a case. You can put it in your own case, of course, or you can pay up to, I think, a couple hundred quid for a massive aluminium case if you wanted. But they got some nice wheeled aluminium jobs.
That's quite good. Not worth popping a link somewhere for that then?
Yeah, I'm very impressed with their stuff. I've bought quite a lot from them over the years. I was really impressed, actually, that they got it to me on the Saturday when I ordered it on the Thursday.
It's very quick delivery.
It was very quick delivery.
Hmm.
So I'm mightily pleased with that.
Excellent. Right. So what did you learn this week?
I learned that no matter how orange and teal you make a movie, and even if Luc Besson wrote the damn thing, it doesn't get better.
I learned that it really is not possible to drag out three celebrities diving into a swimming pool twice each into 90 minutes of primetime entertainment. My God, that was an hour and a half I still don't quite believe, to be honest.
I could do it.
Yeah.
You have two options.
Yeah.
Sharks.
Yeah. Oh, it needed sharks.
Or custard powder.
I thought trampolines.
No, custard powder.
Just below the surface of the water.
Custard
powder. They jump in. Way! Non-Newtonian fluids?
Yeah.
Hmm. That would be quite humorous. Yes.
It'll be fine. Then splat on it and then sink.
I really wish I hadn't watched it, and I don't quite know why I did. Anyway, do your spiel.
You can find us on iTunes and howtomurdertime.com. Please go on to iTunes and leave us a review, because we like reviews. Everyone likes reviews.
Can I my phone see those now?
On iTunes? No.
Okay. Leave comments on the website, on the PC, with what I can see things on.
Yeah.
That would be good.
If you actually want us to see something, howtomurdertime.com is probably a better one. You can also catch us in various games. There is a link on the menu bar of the site saying how you can find us in games. And
mostly
PlanetSide
like 2 at
Xbox
the moment.
Xbox and PlayStation 3 and all manner of things. And on the iPhone as well.
Games and things.
Games and things. And you can also catch me on... moving on, which I haven't quit yet.
Oh, you're still going. All right, what's this week's delight?
Rear Window,
Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, now we're back onto more solid territory, I think.
Bizarre French film was brilliant, but yes.
I need to go and listen to what you thought of that.
And
I recommend you to do, dear listener, because it sounds quite incomprehensible.
And you need to see Bizarre French Film.
I'm not even going to watch it. I'm just going to entirely rely on your recommendation.
Well, we all loved it, so. Yes, and I believe that is everything I need to say.
Excellent. With that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.